From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com. Oil trading on the NYMEX below $70 a barrel. Here to tell us more about oil and fossil fuel is John Kilduff. He is the founding partner of Again Capital. John, always a pleasure. Why do you think the price of oil is going lower?
Well, there was a real sudden development in Libya yesterday morning. It was announced that the two warring factions that had basically been in the process of stopping or halting Libya's oil exports, resolve their differences. There's some actual rumors out there that it was spurred upon by President Trump, of all things. And this oil is rapidly coming back to the market. We're getting more and more good news almost by the hour here, Pim. And it makes a big difference. You're talking about getting about 700,000 barrels a day back online fairly rapidly. And you add that to the recent increases in production by Saudi Arabia, Russia, and some others, and all of a sudden the dire situation that we were looking at is not looking so bad all of a sudden. So we're getting some relief here.
All right. So, John, can you pair that, the idea that Libya production is increasing and we're getting that into the market? Given that, I mean, is that really what's driving things way more than trade war concerns and an expression of fear that the global economy is going to slow down?
Well, I would argue it's a big part of it. But certainly the trade war fears are affecting commodities more than anything else. Obviously, soybeans and getting the headlines on this. But you're seeing copper get hit. You're seeing gold get hit. You're seeing dollar strength, which is driving down these prices as well. And certainly we know that, although it's not on the official list just yet, that the Chinese had intimated that crude oil purchases from the U.S. and natural gas, LNG purchases, were going to be part of their tariff retaliation. So oil's front and center in that as well. So that is definitely part of it. And the fears that global demand will take a hit from the reduced economic activity.
Right. So these things are all sort of coming together as the perfect storm.
But really a confluence, yes, of elements here.
But to sort of counter that, the IEA came out with a report today saying that even if the biggest producers in OPEC basically produce as much oil as they can, that's basically what would be required to offset potential lost production in other places. So that seems sort of bullish for prices, given the supply-demand dynamic. Can you square those things?
Yeah, I think they had an unfortunate printing deadline this month because their numbers out this morning about what the deficit, supply-demand deficit was looking like, that is a deficit of crude oil production, didn't figure in this rapid return of Libyan crude oil. I think their numbers on Saudi Arabia were a little low as well. So they were talking about around a 1.4 million barrel per day deficit later this year. That's probably going to be no more than 200 to 300 now if things hold up, especially in Libya, and we see more of these gains from Saudi Arabia, who was probably on track to put about a million barrels more oil on the market. If you measure it from April when they were at 9.87, they're pushing up towards 10.6, 10.7 already and may go to 11 over the course of the next couple of months. So it's a lot closer. That's when we were surging here recently and we got Brent towards $80 again and WTI back up towards 75. It's because the math was looking terrible.
Right.
But the Saudis really did step up. The Russians really did step up. And this Libya thing was really a bolt out of the blue. I can't say it enough.
So where do you think prices are headed in the near term for both WTI and Brent?
Well, I still think it's a tough slog here from a consumer's perspective. The challenges, you know, remain in big time in Venezuela. There's more lost production month on month. Again, that's continuing to decline. The Trump administration appears to be hell-bent on strangling Iran economically and foreclosing their oil sales. I don't believe for a minute that a single country will get a waiver from escaping the sanctions that prevent their purchasing of Iranian oil. So this is probably a buying opportunity, and prices more likely towards $80 for Brent will be revisited upon us, I think, later in the year. We're not out of the woods yet, although things are looking better.
Well, better for the upside, you mean?
No, I mean better for consumers. I mean, Pim, I mean, you could have easily have made the argument for $85 to $100 a barrel oil if the status quo had been maintained here, if we hadn't seen these rapid changes from Saudi, from Libya and others. That fever really has broken now, given what we're seeing production-wise.
Well, that's where I was going to go with this when you mentioned, Libya, and then you've got Russia, you have Saudi Arabia. But let's just put in, for the sake of argument, that Iran, for whatever reason, manages to export more oil. Nigeria continues with its exports, and maybe even Venezuela gets its act together. These countries, they can't eat the oil. If they all came back online, what do you think the price of oil would be? Give you about 20 seconds.
I think we'd be trading back down towards $50 a barrel if we had all that production online. Plus, we'll get the return of Canada by the end of September. So, I think there's a couple more months of rough sledding, Pim, but things could be looking a lot better by the end of the year from a consumer's perspective, so lower.
John Kilduff, thank you so much for being with us. Always great to get your perspective. John Kilduff is founding partner of Again Capital in New York, talking about the oil markets. Here with us is somebody who has thought a lot about where to produce goods and how to manufacture things efficiently and well. Joseph Aboud, a chief creative director at Men's Warehouse, joining us here in our 1130 studios. He's also the creator of Joseph Aboud Manufacturing Corporation, which is the largest men's tailored clothing factory in the United States. Joseph, it is so good to have you here.
Thank you, Lisa.
And it's interesting because you do most of your business, or you do most of your creations here in the U.S., most manufacturing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, given that, do you think that you're going to be somewhat insulated from all of the trade talk, or will it somehow come back to you?
I really don't know what the ultimate result will be. We've been manufacturing in Massachusetts for 31 years. When I launched the first collection, that's where Joseph Aboud Manufacturing is. And we've seen a steady growth when we've had price increases or price reductions, because we've always tried to price our product fair. So the price value proposition of what we make there, as I had mentioned earlier, we 60% of our manufacturing in that factory, where we have 800 people, is with our custom product. And that's where young guys are now starting to come out and buy suits and making an investment. So we haven't seen any of these issues at the moment really impact us.
Speak, if you can, about the changes in the factory, and you've added workers there, and you're looking to do. Because, when you think about custom suits, mm-hmm. you don't necessarily think that they can be made in the United States, but that's not the case.
It's interesting. We grew organically since 1987. That first year, we produced about 2,000 suits. In the last few years, it's been over 300,000 in that 30-year period. And we have increased our workforce in the last 3.5 years. We've doubled our workforce. And New Bedford has a great character for people with a great work ethic. We're so proud. I mean, of all the things I've ever done, I'm so proud of that factory and the people who work there. It's a really feel-good moment, and we do create a great product.
So actually, speak a little bit more about that, because we hear a lot about, quote, labor shortages or companies having trouble hiring people in the U.S.
Right.
Are you experiencing the same?
Well, it's interesting. We have a sign outside. One of the signs that I love the most in our company is there's a sign outside that factory that says "Now Hiring," and I really love that. We have we really tap into the community. We have a training process when people do come in if they aren't skilled in sewing. So we see that we've supported the community, they've supported us, and we want to continue to do that. We have had that growth, and we really do see it through, you know, what we're manufacturing through our custom business.
You used the word community, and I want you to speak, if you can, about the annual suit drive that
yes.
you put together, because
yes.
you don't just make suits, you also
no.
collect them.
Yeah, well, I think July is our suit drive month, where we basically collect gently worn clothing. We have them come into our 750 men's warehouse stores, and then we refurbish them and then get them back to folks who might want to re-enter the workforce, who might not be able to afford products. And this is our 11th year. We've raised, we've collected 1.6 million garments, and we give them to 150 nonprofits. So good things come from good things.
And I will just say, you are dressed phenomenally today. You walked in and I thought, wow.
A lot of pressure.
Put to shame.
No, it's a lot of pressure. I guess I dressed for TV and I didn't dress for radio.
Yeah. But, no, it's fabulous. I do want to get back to the idea of, you know, how difficult it is to hire right now, mm-hmm. given the tight labor market. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, are you finding that you're having to offer higher and higher salaries and that the increases are accelerating more rapidly?
Well, we obviously always want to be fair to our employees. We have a union shop. We have a great relationship with the union. I've always believed that in that area that it's been a great community of people wanting to work in a great factory. So over the years, we've had the highs and lows of increasing the workforce, but we always really want to dedicate ourselves to the kind of people that we have because they are, in essence, the lifeblood of the business.
Now, maybe the other part of the lifeblood of the business is the customer. And just to continue the theme of the suit drive.
Yes.
If you donate a suit, you get a 50% off coupon.
Yes. And I think that that's also an incentive for people to think about cleaning out their closets. How many of us are hoarders? You know, you have a suit that maybe 5 or 6 years old or 7 years old, probably still in good shape. But are you really going to wear it? And do you want to go out and get a new one? So it's an incentive. But I really think the very essence is to be able to donate those suits and get them on the backs of people who could really use them.
Are you a hoarder of suits? I can't imagine
well,
that.
Well, I keep a lot of things because they're my archives. So I've got things I probably wouldn't wear from my first collections you would probably love. But I keep them because they're either a special moment or...
See, it's not a closet. It's an archive.
Well, it's a museum. Yeah, my closet isn't a closet. It's a museum.
But I really think... Well, for me, it's important to keep those pieces because either they're historic for the brand or they would be great design ideas to reinterpret later on.
I want to thank you very much.
A little bit of an archive.
Thank you very much for dressing up and thanks for coming in. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Lisa.
Joseph
thank you,
Abood is the... Chief Creative Director of Men's Warehouse, yes?
Pim, I'm expecting you to come in fine form tomorrow.
I'll do my best. I can't keep up with Joseph Abood. All right, you can follow Joseph Abood on Twitter, at Joseph Abood. And just to mention the suit drive, check it out on social media. Just use the hashtag give a suit.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
As we continue to talk about straining relationships between the U.S. and China, I think it's important to take a look at, you know, what that relationship actually has been over the past two decades. And with us to help us do that is Brad Setzer. He is the Stephen A. Tannenbaum Senior Fellow for International Economics at the Council of Foreign Relations, also formerly the Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Economic Analysis in the U.S. Treasury Department from 2011 to 2015. Brad, always wonderful having you on. I want to just start with a recent paper that you wrote, taking a look at China's trade practices with the U.S. and taking a look at where gripes are legitimate that the U.S. has with China. Can you just sort of broadly outline some of those?
So, you know, I think there are three broad subsets of policies where the U.S. can sort of legitimately complain that Chinese actions have undermined the intent, if not the letter, that lay behind China's WTO accession. The first is the one that gets all the attention, which is forced technology transfer. China, in theory, cannot require, as a matter of government policy, that a U.S. company transfer technology to a Chinese partner as a condition for market entry. However, in a state-dominated economy, China, the viable partners to form a joint venture tend to be state companies. And the state companies can say, as a matter of commercial decision-making, our own commercial interest, we will require tech transfer as part of any JV. And so the net effect has been a de facto requirement for tech transfer, even though there is no de jure requirement. The second is that China just makes use of domestic subsidies on a scale that no one else does. And it has a market distorting effect that goes beyond that of any other economy. Domestic subsidies are not prohibited by the WTO. You can only bring a WTO case to offset the adverse impact a subsidy has on your exports, and that process is slow. And it just wasn't designed for an economy where pretty much any company that has access to the state banking system de facto has a subsidy, because the intent was to prove a specific subsidy, kind of a budget line item, and that's not quite how China's subsidies work. The third is a bunch of buy China policies that, you know, since you're selling in large measure to large Chinese state companies or companies with heavy state or party influence, there can be informal requirements that if you want to sell to China, you got to produce inside China. And those don't have to be explicit procurement rules. They can just be, hey, you want to sell to the Chinese railway company? It's a state enterprise. You better produce inside China. The cumulative effect has been, I think, a set of real impediments to companies that want to produce outside China and sell into China, as well as a set of fairly onerous requirements if you want to invest in China to produce in China.
Brad, do you believe that this is part of the reason why there seems to be such political frustration with any kind of relationship that's based on, quote, free trade with China? I mean, I noted your description, state-dominated economy, and then I also think about all of the companies that have participation from, let's say, the People's Liberation Army in China. Has the trading system just been set up that doesn't work when you confront that kind of state intervention on such a wholesale level?
I mean, I don't think it works particularly well in an economy where the party controls the state and the party can exercise indirect influence over such a large range of state enterprises. It undoubtedly is part of the reason why there's bipartisan frustration at China. But, you know, on the flip side of all this, is that after the global crisis, China reduced its export dependence through a rather massive domestic stimulus. And so a lot of the macroeconomic distortions that China created before the global crisis have to a degree faded. So it's always a little bit of a mixed bag.
So Brad, this has been an issue for decades. Why hasn't it been dealt with by previous administrations?
Well, at every single point in time, I think people shied away from confrontation. China is a big, important player, not just in the global economy, but in the global security situation. So there's always pressure to make sure that China is cooperating in other areas, you know, the North Korea set of issues,
right,
that kind of thing. And then for a long time, you know, there are constituencies in the U.S. that didn't necessarily want to get too tough on China. There are companies that didn't want to get too tough on China's currency intervention because they were producing in China for export and a weak currency helped them. There are companies that are much more afraid of Chinese retaliation because they've developed successful businesses in China through joint ventures than they are interested in the potential gains from a more confrontational policy. So at each incremental moment, the decision was made to back away from full-on confrontation.
Do you think that the U.S. economy now is strong enough that it is a good time to take on some of these issues, as President Trump and his cabinet have suggested?
Look, I think there's always a debate about whether it is better to take a more confrontational approach when your economy is weak and when you could really benefit, say, from increased exports. When your economy is operating below potential, in theory, the gains from exporting are much larger than they are when your economy is operating at potential. The flip side is that we are better, that, you know, and you can analyze the short-run drag from the trade war as a reversal of a portion of the fiscal stimulus. And since there was probably excessive stimulus in the economy to begin with, in that sense, you know, it's a way of removing the excess stimulus and therefore won't have tremendously negative effects.
Brad, give you about 20 seconds here. You've served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Economic Alliance in the U.S. Treasury. Just game out for us. What do you believe is really going to happen?
Well, you know, I was a mid-ranking official in another administration, and in an administration where trade policy wasn't set in the Oval Office directly by the president. So my general argument now is that take what the president says on trade both literally and seriously, and the best guide to future action is what he has said. And what he has said is that he will continue to escalate. I think the interesting question now is how China chooses to respond. If we go through with the $200 billion in tariffs, we've exceeded U.S. exports to China. And so China, in order to match, would have to look at non-tariff responses.
Thanks very much for being with us. Brad Setzer is from the Council on Foreign Relations and formerly Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Economic Analysis in the U.S. Treasury.
Our next guest is a well-known name in the real estate industry, Scott Lawler, founder and chief executive officer at Waypoint Residential. Normally he's in Connecticut, but he trekked in here to our 1130 studio. Scott, thank you so much for being with us. You have decades of experience in the market, and I want to start with a note that caught my attention that Morgan Stanley wrote, where they were talking about the Bank of Ozarks and their weak earning and how some of their earnings will raise concerns across the banking industry because of their suggestion that commercial real estate standards were weakening and that the area is getting much riskier. What's your take on that?
So in other words, you're saying that there was concern because the Bank of Ozarks was a very active construction lender that they might have some difficulty if the cycle turns?
Well, and that this signals broader weakness in the commercial real estate market, at least as far as fundamentals versus some of the valuations that are being put on them.
Okay. Yeah, I think it might be a bit of a stretch. I mean, one thing that's very, very different about this cycle versus the last cycle, of course, is leverage levels. Okay. And so, Bank of Ozarks, my understanding, would typically play as a first mortgage lender in the construction world, making development loans at reasonable loan-to-value ratios, you know, 55, 60, maybe 65%. And to suggest that we have an imminent cycle that's going to impact the performance of those loans, that's tough to see. I mean, we'd have to have something that I think exceeded what we experienced 10 years ago for a bunch of 60 LTV construction loans to jam up Bank of Ozarks earnings, if that was the implication of the report.
I want to ask you about senior housing and what you're seeing there in terms of the kind of build-out that's happening.
Well, you know, we've gotten into that space about a year and a half ago. We've done a handful of deals. We're very excited about it. There are things to love and things to hate, like anything. The things to love are pretty obvious. Obviously, the demographic sort of tidal wave that's coming represents tremendous demand for the space. Now, of course, everyone knows that, and the upshot is everyone's in the business. And the challenge we're facing is a tremendous amount of capital in the apartment sector has tried to sort of branch out, if you will, the last couple of years, from conventional into senior, student, and so on, and further geographically. And so the playing field is very crowded. Senior is a very, you have to be very careful in the senior business. It's not just real estate. In fact, that's only part of the conversation at best. There are all sorts of operating issues. You have to be smart about knowing what you know and what you don't know and solving for what you don't know to take on one of these assets. So we think we've done that, and I like the space, but you know, it's something you have to tread cautiously, and you have to be careful when the capital comes in, because if you're going to play in a space that is a little bit more operating risk, you ought to be compensated. And what we're seeing are a lot of senior housing deals where the returns are the same as conventional deals, and that's a result of capital flow. And that's when you can really, you know, get burned. So you have to be very, very careful. I love the space. I like it long-term, big picture, but it's a time to proceed cautiously.
Scott, I'm wondering, you know, just since we talk so much here about tariffs and cross-country capital flows, I'm just wondering, do you see a reduction in investments in U.S. real estate from, say, Chinese wealthy individuals?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Where we play geographically, we wouldn't cross paths with that quite as much. You know, historically, foreign capital, whether from China, Persian Gulf, Latin America, what have you, would prefer what I would describe as major coastal metro areas. So you cross paths with that capital, either partnering with it or competing against it, quite a bit more in, you know, New York, D.C., Miami, L.A., San Francisco, versus, say, around, you know, Tennessee and the Carolinas and whatnot, where we invest. So I don't think we've observed any difference in our playing field. My understanding from friends who do some of that other investing is that they have observed, you know, maybe a fall off, for instance, in Chinese capital coming in and so on. But again, it wouldn't impact our business directly that much.
Mid-sized cities in the United States. Tell us about the health of mid-sized cities for the real estate business.
Well, you know, we're obviously a big fan of those markets. I think, you know, those markets represent a little bit more interesting pricing, if you will, than some of the bigger markets because of capital flow. I will say that that dynamic has changed. I thought I was really smart going some of the secondary, tertiary markets 5 years ago.
What, like a Louisville, Kentucky?
Exactly. Or even smaller, you know. We have a lot more friends who've kind of worked their way to those markets, as I was talking about before. The capital has drifted out not only by product, but by geography. So we don't feel quite as, you know, nearly as much sort of ahead of the pack, if you will, as we did several years ago. Nevertheless, I think on a relative basis, it's still fair to say that from our perspective, the risk-adjusted opportunity in secondary and tertiary markets is superior to the risk-adjusted opportunity in major coastal markets. Now, that's a controversial statement. Many of my institutional friends, I'll get some texts saying, how can you sit there and say that?
Really? I hear that from a lot of people.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying. More people are coming our way. But historically, right, you know, cap rates, you know, as we came into this cycle, you know, cap rates in New York and San Francisco fell quite a bit faster than cap rates in, you know, Chattanooga and Greenville and whatnot. And there's some logic, of course, to some spread. But my view is, I thought on a relative basis at the margin, it made more sense in the smaller market. So, you know, we're big believers in mid-sized metros. We think they've changed culturally. We think they've changed commercially. We think, you know, kids getting out of college and moving to a Louisville, Kentucky is a different conversation than 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And so as a result, we're happy to own apartments there. We have to be, same thing, have to underwrite, you know, our locations and our submarkets very carefully and make sure we're comfortable with, you know, diverse and deep demand drivers and all that relative to the size of the market. But to us, it makes terrific sense. And that's very important. I'm saying that for our property type.
Right.
If I was in the office business, I might be a little more cautious in some of those markets, you know, as I used to be.
Scott Lawler, thank you so much for being with us. Scott Lawler is founder and chief executive officer of Waypoint Residential, normally in Connecticut, but joining us here today in our 1130 studios. Right now, let's head over to our 99.1 studios in Washington, D.C. Nancy Lines is there with world and national headlines. Nancy. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.